Moeen Rabbani is a Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst specializing in the Arab-Israeli conflict and Palestinian affairs. As of 2012, Rabbani was based in Amman, Jordan, and was a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, the Palestine director of the Palestine American Research Center, a project director for the Association of Netherlands Municipalities, and a volunteer and general editor for El Haq. Rabbani was a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, a co-editor of Jadaliyah, and a contributing editor to the Middle East Report. He spoke with Nassim Amid, the host of Palestine This Week, about why Israel is so alarmed by France and Saudi Arabia's push to recognize a Palestinian state.
Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries are desperate to normalize relationship with Israel. And I think the only thing that's stopping them is the fact that there is no Palestinian state. If Israel was to accept a Palestinian state, all the Arab countries, as they have said, would normalize relationship with Israel. Israel would be accommodated into the region. This is like a win-win for everybody. But Israel rejects that outright. So I guess, why does it fear two states? Not advocating that as a solution myself. I'm saying, why does Israel fear that when this is its pathway, its route to normalization, its route to being accommodated into the region, its route to peace with everybody in the region? Why does it not do that? And also going back to the other point, you know, what is Starmer doing by using the two-state as kind of a threat against the Israelis?
Well, I think first we have to recognize that Israel has become a compulsively expansionist state. It is simply incapable of retreating from occupied territory, except, you know, as in the case of the Sinai Peninsula after the 1973 war, or southern Lebanon in 2000, except as a result of armed force. And it's certainly not going to do so in the West Bank, which it considers to be, you know, the heartland of Jewish existence. You know, even though I should point out, during the mandate period, the Zionist movement, when it was talking about Judea, was not referring to the southern West Bank, but to the coastal area, roughly between Jaffa and the Gaza Strip. So I just wanted to throw out that tidbit. So yes, you know, it makes eminent sense for Israel to at least be seen to take serious measures towards the establishment of a Palestinian state, but it's incapable of doing so. And of course it will say, you know, security threats and all the rest of it, whereas anyone who's ever looked at this with a even halfway open mind understands that the only reason Israel needs to worry about its security is because of its oppression and apartheid policies against the Palestinians. And that basically, you know, when you reject peaceful coexistence, you're not going to get peaceful coexistence. And it's that simple. Now, Macron's gamble appears to have paid off. What I mean by that is that over the summer, we saw repeated statements coming out of Paris that the French president, Emmanuel Macron, wanted to put recognition of Palestinian statehood on the agenda, but for maximum effect, he wanted to do this in as part of a broader coalition of the willing, if you will. You know, Germany, forget it, and the two states that he chose, interestingly enough, were Great Britain, which is no longer a member of the EU, and Canada, which is, of course, the immediate neighbor of the United States. And the significance would be that here you have three G7 members. I believe all three are G7 members. Mm-hmm. That would simultaneously recognize a Palestinian state. It seemed that fearing the U.S. backlash, London and Ottawa didn't proceed, and Macron then took a unilateral French initiative last week, in which he announced that France intends to formally recognize Palestinian statehood at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly this fall. it's a statement of intent. It's not a statement of recognition. A lot can happen in the interim. Now, what happened in Britain is that on the one hand, you have a lot of members of the Labour Party, of the Parliamentary Labour Party, who either genuinely believe that their country, you know, which after all created this whole problem, should recognize Palestinian statehood, or are terrified of losing the next election because British public opinion, particularly in Labour constituencies, is so overwhelmingly supportive of Palestinian self-determination. And now you have this threat of a new party to the left of Labour, led by Jeremy Corbyn and Zahra Sultana, that's probably not going to form the next government, but can ensure that a lot of current Labour members of parliament will no longer be members of parliament after the next election. So you have this absolutely crazy situation now where someone like Wes Streeting, the Minister of Health, and probably the most pro-Israeli Brit since Arthur James Balfour,
held his seat by only 600 votes.
Yes, is now pretending that Palestinians are human beings, as far as he's concerned, for exactly the reason you mentioned. He almost lost the election. Yeah. So that's the dynamic I have, and. In that context, Keir Starmer at this a conference organized at the United Nations by France and co-organized by France and Saudi Arabia, Keir Starmer on Tuesday said that if that Britain intends to recognize Palestinian statehood at the UN General Assembly meeting, if Israel does not take concrete steps to do one or the other. But it seems that Macron, his initiative, created a wave of pressure on Starmer to do this, and appears to have worked. We'll see what happens next in Canada, which of course sits right across the border from the United States. And I think that was Starmer's approach too, you know, more frightened of daddy in the White House than he is of his own people and his own voters. But there's a broader issue here. You know, yes, recognition is politically symbolic and politically significant, particularly when it comes from, in this case now, two G7 members, and just as importantly, two members of the United Nations Security Council. I mean, if it indeed happens. But if it is not paired, in fact, preceded by energetic action to end the famine in the Gaza Strip, if it is not paired with concrete action to end the genocide in the Gaza Strip, if you have recognition on the one hand, arms deliveries to Israel on the other hand, it becomes political theater and a diversion. So the real challenge for France, for Britain, for all these other states, is not whether they will finally recognize Palestinian statehood, which the rest of the world has already done decades ago, but rather, will they use their uniquely powerful leverage over Israel to bring this horrific genocide to an end? In Britain's case, a special responsibility, of course, because it created this whole issue after the First World War. Without Britain, we wouldn't be having this conversation, let alone talk about it every week. And in France's case, because people often forget that before 1967, Israel's main arms supplier was not the United States, it was France. And it was France that enabled Israel to illegally develop a nuclear arsenal.
For KEPW News, I'm Curtis Blankenship.
It's like,
I don't know, I think not recording the Q&A.
I mean, if someone scanned it, I never put the PDF up anywhere, but yeah. just because I kind of knew I was coming out with a book version soon and I wanted to have it out for that. I'll wait. Just a couple people that I know are going to come back. I'll wait till they get back. Maybe they're getting more chairs. Yeah. Sweet. All right. Let's see who else. Maybe. I don't know. Well, there's a few more people coming in.
I can grab some more.
Okay. Hello. Yeah, I figured we'd probably start 5 or 6 minutes late anyway, so. All right. Oh, you're right behind me. I was like, what should I do? No, you can sit. You can sit wherever you want. Yeah. Cool. I think as soon as the folks getting a few more chairs get back, I'll get started. So other than I see them coming over right now. Sweet. Thank you all for coming out. This is exciting. This is actually my first time ever giving this book talk. The book itself only just put it into print. We bound them last Thursday, so it is brand new, hot off the press. If some of y'all overheard a little bit, we were talking about there was a much shorter zine version of this book that was out that we had last time we were here in Corvallis, but this is the first time I've had this book here. So I'm Gia, for I think most of y'all don't know me. I'm going to be talking today about my brand new book, Deconstructing Settler Socialism, Anarchism, and the Internationals in the Wild West. And yeah, as I said, this is my first time ever giving this talk, so if I'm a little nervous or shaky, just bear with me. Y'all get the official release, I suppose. I'm just going to kind of talk for like an hour, if that's all right. I kind of have some of it's sort of just kind of excerpts from the book, and some of it's kind of just summaries and brief thoughts on kind of some of the main themes and stories and events that kind of make up the book. And after I talk for a while, we can kind of have some time for Q&A and discussion at the end. If folks want to kind of have it be a little more round table discussion, that's great. If people have specific questions, I'm happy to answer them to the best of my ability. But with all that said, I'm just going to get started. If I'm speaking too quietly, if I need to speak up, please feel free to let me know real quick. I'm happy to try to project a little bit more. I might take some breaks for water in a couple moments, but without further ado, November 3rd, 1885, Tacoma, Washington Territory, swindled Puyallup land. The steam whistle at Lister's Tacoma Ironworks blasted through the driving rain at precisely 9:30 a.m. Whistles from other factories soon added to the harsh chorus. Their wails normally signal the start of a day's work. This Tuesday morning was different. Hundreds of white men and women assembled on Pacific Street. The crowd marched from their meeting spot, advancing systematically through the city along a pre-planned route. Some of their bitter opponents later proclaimed them a rather orderly mob, orderly meaning well-organized. Despite countless paradoxical proclamations to the contrary, this crowd was not here to keep the peace. Their intent had always been understood implicitly, but was also loudly proclaimed. Months of preparation were finalized the night before by the Committee of Nine. This small collection of socialist and anarchist radicals was affiliated with a mysterious group called the International Workmen's Association. They assigned one another responsibility to spread the word through their networks. Overnight, they canvassed the white residents of designated neighborhoods. The tragic culmination of months of agitation, organization, and escalation was at hand. Soon after its start, this orderly yet ruthless crowd was joined by an old radical German immigrant, Tacoma's shopkeeper mayor, Jacob Weisbach. Weisbach sometimes boasted that he had sheltered famous revolutionary Giuseppe Mazzini after his flight from Italy following the upheavals of 1848. He professed sympathy with the anarchist Pierre Joseph Proudhon and claimed that repression resulting from these associations might have forced his departure from Europe. The mayor always proclaimed himself an advocate for the oppressed classes he considered to be the real producers within society. Weisbach oversaw the proceedings alongside the sheriff and the judge. In the minds of all these revolutionaries, the horrific acts to follow were the start of a new era. Weisbach's proclaimed goal of a harmonious society necessitated atrocity. His vision for a producer's republic on this newly stolen land was nauseatingly sterile white. On this dreadful day, it seemed one step closer to reality. The crowd passed each and every building and neighborhood home to the city's hundreds of Chinese residents. At each designated building, they busted indoors. Every Chinese person inside was informed that the people commanded them out of the city. Men in the crowd beat several of their victims. Those who hesitated were dragged out by the mob. All understood the threat implied by the Winchester rifles and revolvers carried by many in the crowd. Some of the crowd even commandeered a boat to invade Kwok-su's waterfront building. He recalled them taking a great many of my goods and carried them into the boat. They also put me out of the house. The wind was blowing a gale, it was raining hard. Some of the Chinese lost their trunks, some their blankets, many were crying. One Chinese resident managed to telegram the governor. He pled for previously promised protection. None came. 200 people were rounded up. Hundreds more had already left in the weeks prior, fearing this very fate. Laborers, merchants, servants, and spouses were first forced on foot and a handful of wagons to Lakeview Station by 3 p.m., miles south of town. Armed white men, many on horseback, escorted the newly minted refugees. Two Chinese men died of exposure waiting for the train to Portland the next day. Many couldn't afford the fare and walked over 100 miles to that Oregon city. When they arrived in Portland or some other refuge, it was their own Chinese immigrant community that took care of them during the arduous months and years to come. A sweeping wave of related catastrophes rocked hundreds of towns and cities in the surrounding months. Tacoma's 1885 anti-Chinese pogrom was no isolated horror. For decades prior and for decades to come, anti-Chinese violence was a bedrock of the white settler labor movement in so-called Western North America. White supremacy was the casting mold for labor unions of hard rock miners, railroad workers, and urban tradespeople. Stories from this era of the labor movement still circulate widely, praising the militancy of unions like the Knights of Labor and the Western Federation of Miners. For white labor history nerds, the 1880s represents a sort of mythical heroic age. Yet an uncomfortable truth lies buried under fables of armed workers confronting exploitive robber barons and state militias. The construction of the white supremacist settler colonial empire that is the United States was not merely a top-down affair. We who envision and fight for another world must struggle with how idols of the past, figures and movements we may be inclined to identify with at first glance, helped construct the very nightmare we seek to wake from today. The early history of anarchic ideas that set my mind ablaze once felt remote. It can be hard to intimately relate with endlessly retold stories of 19th century Eurobeards as an anarchist who's lived her entire life west of the Mississippi River. Parisian barricades, London exile committees, Spanish revolutionary unions, and Russian nihilist assassins make for fascinating reading, but are all rather far from home. In most general histories of radical movements covering this early period, the region popularly remembered as the Wild West is entirely absent. At best, it appears as a peripheral subject necessitating deliberate search. Digging ever deeper into the story of my home, I've come to realize the danger posed by this omission when contemplating radical history. During the 19th century, these lands were violently transformed from the sovereign domain of dozens of indigenous peoples into Western North America via the genocidal process of settler colonialism. Much as I might hope otherwise, white radicals played a tragically intimate role in this process from the jump. The histories of anarchism and communism, of socialism, feminism, and syndicalism have long roots in these lands, but those who tilled the soil were far from spotless heroes. No organization is more frequently associated with the origins of these intertwined ideas than the International Working Men's Association. The International facilitated an uneasy union between a broad spectrum of anti-capitalist movements in the 1860s and 70s, originally centered in Europe. It's often called the First International in light of innumerable later bodies claiming to revive its legacy of uniting militant working class organizations across national borders. Generations of Marxists have their second, third, and countless fourth internationals. Many anarchists carried on a decades-long tradition of considering their own transnational bodies mere continuations and reconstitutions of the original London-founded organization, some of them still calling for a renewed Black Anarchist International. The International Working Men's Association did not invent anarchism, communism, or social democracy. All were circulating and developing among radical workers and intellectuals in Europe and its settler colonies for decades prior prior to its founding. Profound and often unrecognized influences also originated in lifeways and ideologies cultivated by people suffering under the colonial yoke. The International Working Men's Association nevertheless played a decisive role in popularizing and differentiating various radical ideologies rooted in European and, by extension, settler American contexts. Its members laid key organizational foundations for broader movements to come. The International was formally established in 1864. It and varying declared successors in the immediate following decades are the primary focus of this talk. Most books and essays on the International Working Men's Association focus on its European activities, but the International was not exclusively a European body. The various radical networks it grew from spanned oceans from the onset. The furthest flung major hub was San Francisco, though it has only been mentioned in a handful of pages worth of published research. This rapidly growing frontier metropolis was established on land seized by the United States a mere 2 decades before it was the site of the 1869 chartering of the first formal local section of the International on the continent. Despite a slow start abetted by San Francisco's then remote location, the International laid deep roots in the city's radical milieu. By the 1880s, San Francisco hosted its own homegrown revival of the International, known as the International Workmen's Association rather than Working Men's. Early internationalists drew up the blueprint for a budding region-wide militant labor movement spread from Denver to Vancouver. We often look to history as a source of inspiration. Well-known watchwords like agitate, educate, organize, and symbolism like the Union Made label were pioneered by these Western radicals. But history can also serve as a warning and an uncomfortable mirror for the present, forcing us to re-examine these practices in a new light. Many of the actions taken by these Wild West internationalists were atrocious, and not merely when judged through a present-day lens. The very foundation of a regional fighting labor movement, still valorized today, was a widespread wave of anti-Chinese violence cultivated by decades of white union feminist and socialistic agitators. Many of these same agitators and others they viewed as comrades fought long and hard to claim land for their own advancement by participating in the active genocidal theft of land from its original inhabitants. Collective colonization was a pillar of their radical practice. We cannot separate these radicals and their movements from the violent settler colonial transformation occurring in their midst. Many played an enthusiastic and active role, though at times facing righteous opposition from within and without. Colonial complicity held dire consequences for the global liberatory potential of their movements. The lands on which they organized were already soaked with blood. More would be shed to transform vast swaths of a continent from the sovereign territories of dozens of indigenous nations into America. As a firm believer in the necessity of intersectional resistance, I've had to reckon with the dark reality that a narrower exclusionary model of solidarity can be profoundly effective for attaining certain self-centered ends. European immigrants from a variety of backgrounds collaborated together in the creation of whiteness, ensuring material comfort to generations of their descendants. Pale-faced women articulated their own oppression through the lens of white supremacy, allying with white male counterparts in viewing black or Asian men as the greatest threat to their own advancement in the system. A veneer of working class unity could be achieved not by uniting all who toiled, but by narrowly defining who belonged within that class as only comprising so-called skilled laborers, while jealously guarding access to said labor. Material gains were delivered over the backs of those thrown under the bus. Let's return now to the International Working Men's Association. The International emerged from the exile networks of defeated revolutionaries during European-wide upheavals in the years following 1848, but also through continuing cross-border exchanges between ongoing socialistic working class and radical democratic movements. Founded in London in September 1864, the International had ties in cities like Paris, Geneva, and New York from the very inception. Intended to act as a coordinating body for labor movements across borders, the International hoped to prevent the working classes of one country from being pitted against those in others in military or economic conflict. One influential early member was Karl Marx, who received a late invite to attend the founding convention, but was nominated to serve on the committee writing the organization's statutes. Marx's draft was accepted as the organization's general rules, yet it was common for radicals of various cultural and ideological backgrounds to quite literally translate its contents into a language more acceptable to their specific sentiments. a line in Marx's English language draft, for instance, implied that political and electoral action was a primary means to achieving the economic emancipation of the working class. French translations, including one formalized at the International's first Congress, General Congress in 1866, typically left out as a means and implied that political activity was entirely subordinate to other actions. Anarchistic elements often pointed to this translation to reject Marx's insistence on forming political parties. The rules preamble declared that all societies and individuals adhering to it would base their conduct on truth, justice, and morality without regard to color, creed, or nationality. Yet Marx had a particularly narrow and, frankly, racist obsession with civilizational progress that narrowed this horizon in what more or less became the general rule's definition of internationalism, stating that the emancipation of labor is neither a local nor a national, but a social problem, embracing all countries in which modern society exists, and depending for its solution on the concurrence, practical and theoretical, of the most advanced countries. The qualifiers modern and most advanced were not arbitrary filler, but reflected Marx's particular view of the linear nature of progress. To him, the social problems faced by laboring classes in countries deemed less advanced were fundamentally different than workers in Europe or the United States, and there could be no meaningful basis for solidarity. This would later emerge as a point of conflict. Turning our eyes back to San Francisco, as the metropolitan heart of the expanding U.S. Empire's Pacific Coast, San Francisco grew rapidly after its violent 1848 acquisition in the Mexican-American War, spurred by an unprecedented gold rush that resulted in a genocidal campaign of extermination targeting California's numerous indigenous peoples. In just two decades, from 1848, San Francisco swelled from a backwater port built on the lands of the Ohlone people, known as Yerba Buena, to the U.S.'s 10th largest city with 150,000 inhabitants. At the end of the 1860s, it was also the terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad. The rapid completion of the western half of this line would have been impossible without the blood and sweat of tens of thousands of Chinese immigrant workers. Chinese people had crossed the Pacific for centuries, including on colonial Spanish Manila galleons, but a massive wave arrived in North America with the gold rush. While early Chinese miners often worked on contract for wealthier Chinese merchants, many others formed small-scale egalitarian mining cooperatives following practices first pioneered back in their home country and further developed in Chinese diaspora in Southeast Asia. As the easiest gold deposits began to run dry by the 1860s, though, some turned to employment in emerging urban industries, while others took up railroad construction labor. Roughly a quarter of California's workforce were Chinese, but white men enjoyed far more job prospects and opportunities to acquire land of their own. Stolen land, I might add. The few white people who volunteered for the railroad were ultimately not displaced by Chinese workers, but rather upgraded to higher-paying supervisory, technical, and supply roles. With limited other options, Chinese workers were forced to accept lower pay, but that is absolutely not to imply that they were the submissive mass imagined by Chinese white contractors. Many fled job sites despite their contracts to escape fucked up conditions. Several thousand Chinese workers even threw down their tools on June 24, 1867. They struck to demand shorter hours and equal pay with those few white workers joining them on the hardest tasks. Railroad management blockaded their camp with the aid of Chinese merchants to cut off food and other supplies. The strike lasted a full week before they were starved into submission. Perhaps 1,000 Chinese laborers would ultimately die by the time the line was completed in 1869. Many capitalists expected Chinese workers to accept lower wages than their white counterparts. These workers often took what they could get, but frequently demanded more. White train unionists could have reached out a hand in solidarity, demanding equal wages for all. They refused, perceiving a racialized threat in increasing Chinese urban employment. Working class clubs called anti-coolie clubs, like a statewide association headed by San Francisco's General A.M. Nguyen, were formed at this time as vehicles for fighting a racist war over the shop floor. The myth that Chinese immigrant workers were imported under a quasi-slave regime had pernicious staying power in white labor circles, and the abolition of slavery post-Civil War heightened its rhetorical significance. Its limited basis in reality was that a minority of emigres leaving China were indeed bound by indenture contracts, but these workers did not travel to North America, but rather Cuban or other Caribbean plantations, as well as Peruvian guano mining islands. These heavily exploited workers typically came from the absolute poorest spheres of Chinese society and typically lacked family support systems back home. the vast majority of Chinese immigrants to California came from many of the same backgrounds as European and American, white American arrivals. Back home, they were farmers, artisans, mechanics, and merchants. Those with existing resources paid their own passage. Families sometimes pooled resources to send one or two members over, while others utilized the so-called credit ticket system, borrowing money from their passage from clan or district associations or from merchants in China. They were expected to pay back these loans from interest, but despite rough conditions in southern China being a major push factor, they largely came of what could be called their own free will. In the United States, they were not bound to any particular master and often worked a cycle of jobs to eventually pay off the loan while sending money to their families. The reality is that Chinese people arriving in San Francisco exercised resources and agency in seeking their fortune on this stolen land as much as they were seeking escape. Though often finding themselves trapped in the brutal grind of wage labor, in this respect they shared much with those European-American immigrants possessing or borrowing the necessary resources to travel to the far distant West. The dependency on powerful Chinese merchants that Euro-Americans frequently lambasted was something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. As working-class Chinese faced increasing rejection from their white counterparts, merchant-run native place associations provided essential support. Twin faces of solidarity and control helped entrench the communal power of Chinese merchants, while laborers were increasingly instrumentalized to serve broader colonial goals, a trend certainly not limited to their ethnic enclave. Many radical European exiles carried early conceptions of internationalism with them when they arrived in San Francisco. But this only formally manifested in a section of the International Workingmen's Association formed by German immigrants in 1869. Tragically, these San Francisco sections would narrow the potentially broad horizons of internationalism. This early section did not involve direct communication with London, but rather with organizers in Geneva, Switzerland, which was a major hub for a nascent group of German language sections. Several of the early members were exiles of the defeated 1848 revolutions who forged connections with old comrades from those in the struggle. Many, like Philip Ryder, were initially more interested in what they viewed as the international support for freedom struggles back home, but they soon came to believe that their section needed to forge local ties with what they called native workers, that is, white Americans, who were hardly more native to recently conquered San Francisco than they themselves, or for that matter, the Chinese workers who built the railroad that brought many of them over. Their early efforts concentrated on reaching out to the Mechanic State Council, a loose unifying body for San Francisco's early white trade unions with connections in other cities, headed by the aforementioned General A.M. Nguyen. Philip Ryder believed that they could awaken a socialist consciousness within this body, perhaps even convince it to affiliate with the International. Yet this did not mean opposing the Council's rabid anti-Chinese organizing. The Council had intimate ties with the parallel network of anti-coolie clubs dedicated to driving Chinese workers out of industries and the land altogether. Ryder, in fact, thought white workers facing need and hunger through competition from the Chinese would view our social aspirations less haughtily and join together as supporters. This would set an ominous pattern for the activities of many later West Coast internationalists. At the same time, the German section briefly pursued an attempt to establish a cooperative colony on recently stolen federal land, utilizing the provisions of the Homestead Act. While their efforts at this time proved fruitless, the attempts of later internationalists went further down this line. While this early German section was organizing, exiled French radicals in San Francisco were forming networks of their own. Amid a war between France and the German states in 1871-71, shared opposition to the war formed the basis for connections between French and German internationalists largely outnumbered within their own communities. The result was a local French section of the International Workingmen's Association, which soon began publishing their own paper titled L'Internationale. This was soon followed by a so-called American section that ran meetings in English. Like the German section, both the French and American sections in San Francisco initially took up significant opposition to Chinese workers. At the American section's founding, the chair stated that one object of the internationals was to prevent operators of one country being crushed by the importation of cheap labor from another, that they recognized in full the principle that it was the first duty of every man to protect himself, and that so long as Chinese or other labor had a tendency to degrade rather than elevate labor, so long would the association legitimately be arraigned against it. Many early members of the International, particularly its American sections, were spiritualists, part of a radically decentralized proto-feminist dissident religious movement that grew out of old abolitionist circles and believed in the personal ability to commune with spirits beyond the pale of the afterlife. Most people associate spiritualism with mediums and seances. The first opposition to the local International's blatant white supremacist stance would ultimately come from within this milieu. By 1872, a number of conflicts within the International Workingmen's Association caused a series of splits in the organization. Most famously, a controversial General Congress in The Hague expelled anarchists James Guillaume and Mikhail Bakunin, only to have the majority of European members and the largest national federations depart with them, most notably those of Spain and Italy. At the same time, the International and the United States splintered, with rival factions aligning themselves with those in Europe, even though the terms of disagreement were sometimes reversed. For instance, the American Marxist-aligned faction agreed with their European counterparts on the need for organizational centralization, but while Marx and his European associates privileged political and parliamentary agitation, their American allies largely rejected electoralism entirely in favor of a narrow focus on trade union organizing. Meanwhile, the European Federalist Wing, often known as the Euro International, found common cause with many American sections who upheld local section autonomy, but while the majority of the European Eurogroup outright rejected political action in favor of workplace organizing as a stepping stone to revolution, the general trend within the American Federalist Wing was inclined to radical, democratizing political movements seeking black and women's suffrage, though they were also involved in union unemployed struggles. Most analyses of the splits in the International have focused on both personal grudges as well as these broad ideological debates around organizational centralization versus federation, political versus workplace activity, and national versus transborder structures. One less commented on, but no less important debate, held tremendous import for the future scope of internationalism itself. Founded in Europe, and with only a handful of non-white members, the International was a long way from representing the global working class in the words of its statutes without regard to creed, color, or nationality. San Francisco's sections had already broken with this ideal. They locally established what was in effect a white-only multilingual coalition, vocally refusing to accept Chinese workers for membership. In so doing, the San Franciscans excluded them from their vision of the working class. This could not remain a California matter. What was called the Chinese question was debated across oceans within the International and became a significant, if rarely noticed, factor in the organization's split. Support or opposition to attempts by white settler workers in California to exclude their Chinese counterparts did not merely follow, but helped shape the battle lines of centralizers and federalists. The crux of this debate still carries weight for radicals today. Must revolution be approached intersectionally, or can a narrow view of class set aside questions of race, of gender, of coloniality, and more for after the revolution? In July 1872, as the faction fight was heating up, some members of the International's General Council proposed striking the words modern society and advanced countries from the general rules. And arguing that the line from the general rules arguing that the emancipation of labor was a social problem embracing all countries in which modern society exists and depending on its solution on the concurrence of the most advanced countries. They hoped to embrace the people of all countries. One supporter argued that modern society itself was the enemy. It had accumulated capital and machinery in the hands of a class and made the mass of the people wage slaves, rendering the International necessary. Ultimately, they were voted down. Friedrich Engels, one of Marx's closest allies, argued bitterly from a perspective of distinct phases of civilization, claiming that it was absurd to imagine that the slaves of Cuba and Brazil, or the population of China and India, could at once be developed into associative laborers. They must first be made free laborers before they could be emancipated. To take out the words modern society would be to take out the pith. At the same time, European federalists were arguing that it was entirely possible to advance from what might be characterized as feudalism and slavery to freedom without necessarily passing through industrial capitalism. Mikhail Bakunin, in The Political Theology of Miazzini and the International, argued, albeit in something of a paternalistic fashion, that Chinese workers in California were serving an apprenticeship in liberty, dignity, rights, and human respect. He insisted that it was not enough that Europe and America should emancipate themselves and form a grand federative republic, founded on emancipation and solidarity labor. For any revolution against all authority to be secure, it must be triumphant in Africa and especially in Asia. White California workers reaching out a hand in solidarity was, to Bakunin, perhaps the only way by which revolution might be carried back across the Pacific. The anarchist geographer Élisée Reclus took this argument even further and insisted that white workers needed to unite with Chinese workers in order to claim in common the full product of their labor. As the global power of capital increased and consolidated, it could only be matched by an equally internationally minded working class. Reclus was informed by extensive study of global history and geography, and in an article published in the Eurofederation's Bulletin, he laid out the extensive history of Chinese toilers fighting back against oppression. European workers' associations and cooperatives find their masters and predecessors in China, while in our part of Western Europe, workers' associations are still the exception. They have been the uniform rule for centuries in the Far East. The arguments made by Reclus and Bakunin were shared by their Federalist counterparts across the Atlantic. Victoria Woodhull, a prominent spiritualist associated with the International in New York, denounced U.S. senators who voted to deny Chinese immigrant citizenship as dancing the jump Jim Crow. Meanwhile, their Marxian-aligned rivals in the U.S., led by one Friedrich Zorga, passed a resolution decreeing that the members of the International Association of the United States are required to support the anti-Chinese political and social movement and to join it, even if they see no chance of success. One article in the San Francisco French section's organ, L'Internationale, declared that the International Association proclaims human solidarity and wishes to apply it immediately as far as the situation allows. It is ready to admit in its bosom any member without distinction of sex, color, or nationality, but as a natural consequence of the above-mentioned principle, it demands reciprocity. Therefore, the day when a Chinese man knocks at its door with the formal intention of regulating his conduct according to said principles, he'll be welcomed. As for others, if they do not want to submit to them, if they cannot mutually contribute with us to progress and to our emancipation, if by coming to us they become the instruments with which capitalists can most surely fight and destroy our tendencies to tear us from their clutches, we say to them, withdraw, you are not one of us. In this and many other proclamations, Chinese people were blamed for white people's desire to exclude them from the United States and the International Workingmen's Association. A theoretical door was left open for future Chinese membership in a painful attempt not to contradict the organization's ostensible founding principles. But after ranting for a couple thousand words about Chinese workers' supposed servile nature and economic threat, this author clearly did not expect the opening to be utilized. The firm support of Friedrich Zorga and his allies for Chinese exclusion ultimately won him the loyalty of all three of San Francisco's sections, German, French, and American. Most German sections in the United States ultimately aligned with Zorga's and, by extension, Marx's faction, and while the French sections were rather more divided in their loyalties, San Francisco's American section was notably the only one to align itself with Zorga from the very start of the split. Take a quick water break.